Welcome back, everybody. This is, I think, a historic moment that is kind of a nice fruition of a lot of effort that's gone on with the USC News Film Library's staff has been extraordinarily active in the more than the last year, but especially in the past year through a partnership with the Library of Congress to do movie-tone newsreel preservation and other projects. But it's also a great moment because in the room today probably is as much living memory, history, and knowledge about the whole enterprise of Fox Silent Newsreels, Fox Movietone, as has been assembled perhaps in a long time, maybe ever, I'm not sure. In addition to the speakers who we're going to hear on the panel officially, we also have in the house someone who was in a silent Fox newsreel, someone whose father worked for Fox Newsreel in the silent period, someone who worked for Fox Movietone News before, during, and after World War II. We also have in the house Peter Bregman, the archivist and kind of collective knowledge database of Fox Movietone News in New York, and David Shepard, who worked with the Movietone collection extensively in the 1970s, writing, producing, directing, cutting, editing Lowell Thomas Remembers TV series, who also knows a lot of extraordinary things. And I believe, David, it's accurate you told me you reconstructed Fox News 1, number 1, from 1919 many years ago. So it's an amazing amount of stuff going on here that's going to make this really exciting. But I'm going to turn it over now to Mike Michon and Greg Wilsbacher, who are co-chairing this session.
Thank you, Dan. I'm Mike Michon from the Library of Congress. Greg's the good-looking one. pardon my voice this morning. I was out late last night rooting on two of my alma maters to victory in basketball last night. They're playing each other on Saturday night. I will be a wreck. I'm very honored to be here to this panel, which is about collaboration. Essentially, fewer words are sweeter to the ear than collaboration, and I say this as somebody of French descent. But this being a panel about World War II, we're celebrating a collaboration of the Movietone News Film Library here at the University of South Carolina, which is a fabulous collection. And the Fox Movietone material that we hold at the Library of Congress. It's a very unique opportunity that was presented to us a little more than a year ago, and we're incredibly excited to be working together on this. So essentially, people in South Carolina and Washington, soon to be Culpeper, Virginia, are working on what's more or less an interstate jigsaw puzzle. And I have colleagues here who are going to be telling you more about that, specifically my colleague George Williman, who's the Nitrate Vault Manager in Dayton, Ohio, will be talking about some of the preservation work that we've done, and then two people who've been working very closely on this project who are recently hired, Jennifer Snyder at the Library of Congress and Fu Nguyen at here in Columbia will be talking with more specifics about the kind of work that they're doing on the Fox Movietone collection in their respective areas. But the person who's really going to set us up and knows the most about it and will tell us a little bit about the nature of the collections, how they came to be split apart, and what we're doing to at least in some very fundamental ways bring them back together again is Greg Wilsbacher, who's the head of the News Film Library, and he'll be walking us through the rest of the program. Greg, thank you.
You were going to have some fun slides, so you put the wrong one up.
My fun slides come late.
Okay. And hopefully, we'll come back to life here. Pardon? Oh, I just lost my. I'm going to put this PowerPoint on, but ooh, I just lost the, there it is.
Yeah, go ahead and put the slide up first.
Okay. what I'm going to do today is, well, the Now It Can Be Shown newsreel, which is something that we'll show here in a second, was released in December of 1942. Part of this project that we have, that since the Fox News spans from 1919 all the way through 1963, was to try to identify a spot in the shared sense of film that where there was some overlap, a lot of overlap, and a discrete unit that if we worked on it kind of intensively for a small period of time, that we would have a kind of usable, shareable product with the rest of the archival community and the general public. And what sticks out in that whole period is about a 5 or 6 year period of World War II materials, paper and film, and if we got it all sorted out, got it cataloged, indexed, digitized, we could create something very nice to put online for everybody that they could share, and that would be both a research tool and a way of raising general interest about the Fox Movie Tone News project overall. But Now It Can Be Shown is a way, this is the title of the Pearl Harbor film that was shown in December of 1942 after the government had held on to the camera negative film that Fox had shot in Pearl Harbor in December of 41. And I also think it makes a nice metaphor for what we've been doing over the last year. I think we're kind of ready to talk a little bit about what we're trying to accomplish. I think the first thing to do is to make sure everybody's up to speed on what Fox Newsreels and Fox News really are. The most important thing, and I think the greatest point of confusion comes in, is when people talk about Fox Movie Tone News. And in part, that's because Fox Movie Tone News Incorporated is the company that owned all the newsreels. But there were two newsreels. One is called Fox News, and that was started in August 1919. And that ran until March of 1930. It went through 11 volumes, released roughly twice a week, as most newsreels would be. That enterprise ended, obviously, with the popularity of sound. Fox Movie Tone News is the name for the sound newsreel, and that began in 1927. There were early sound experiments that were released under the title of Fox Movie Tone as exhibitions throughout 27, most famously the Lindbergh films. But it wasn't started as an official newsreel until 27, and it got really rolling in 28, and then ran until 1963. After 1963, when Fox Movie Tone News Incorporated basically shut down its major sense of operations, it kind of went into limbo. And I've never had the pleasure of going to the Ogdensburg, New Jersey vaults, but that's what you're looking at a picture of. I know David's probably been there. A couple other people in the room I know from my staff have been there. This is just one of the many vaults that are there. You can see that they're from another period. There's broken glass on the top. And this is where the film sat for a long period of time. By 1975, however, there was a lot of concern growing. We're quite delighted by the fact that Raymond Bennett, the vice president of 20th Century Fox back in the 70s and the early 80s, the vice president for taxes and public relations, donated us several banker's boxes of memos from the 20th Century Fox company that he was party to that helped us understand better the inner workings of the ideas and the movements and within the executives about what they should do with the Fox collection. And from what I can tell, it's around 1975, there was an alarm bell going off that Jack Muth was sounding in some part, that there was the Ogdensburg vaults were a big problem, that the nitrate was rotting fast, and they ought to do something. And it looks to be, from what I can tell, that there was there probably is somebody here who might know better, that there was an effort to print most initially feature materials that were stored in the Ogdensburg, New Jersey vaults. In the mid-70s, that was a project that they just started rolling on. And they were still then thinking about what they were going to do with this extremely large, some estimated up to 60 to 50, 60 million feet of nitrate film. Estimates ranged quite widely from one year to another. That was sitting here in Ogdensburg in a New York vault. Boy, that didn't come out as well when I converted it. Well, you know, it's not a good jacket either, but I put that up. I shouldn't make fun of Lowell Thomas. He's a good guy. Lowell Thomas Remembers was a series that was created. It aired initially in 75. I think it ran through at least 77. I don't know when the end date was, and David might remember. Three seasons? Yeah. Over 200 episodes, something like that. 132. 1 hour each. I think they aired on Sunday nights on PBS. Lowell talked about they basically went back to the Movie Tone Library and kind of culled it for the greatest hits for different themes or a different year and produced it. And they were very kind of, we have some scripts in our library. The production, the PBS facility that was actually the base for the production within PBS was here in South Carolina in Columbia at the South Carolina ETV station, which is a couple of miles down the road.
Black Hawk was intimately involved with the production of it, and so was Movie Tone News, Inc. in New York. And so we had this triangular relationship of film going back and forth. The first director of the News Film Library, Jim Jackson, was... I don't know if this was his brainchild or what, but I have a memo that says that he was retained by 20th Century Fox in 1974 as a consultant in order to help them come up with ideas of how to better use the library as a money-generating tool, as something other than just a stock footage library for other people who were looking for 5 seconds of this or 5 seconds of that. It isn't maybe by accident that in 1975 he was consulting with leaders in the state saying that, I guess he got paid by 25th Century Fox to consult for them, and then he came back here, and it's no surprise that he thought that the best thing to do would be to bring it to South Carolina. But that was the plan, and so there was a very early conversation about bringing it to South Carolina. That eventually evolved into what was called the priceless gift. You see it in headlines and in newspapers from the period. The gift was announced shortly after, well, almost a year after the Suitland, Maryland fires that consumed the Universal Nitrate in 1978. By 1979, there were two meetings of the board. The first was the meeting of the board of the Movietone News, Inc. on December 13th that voted unanimously to donate the entire library to the University of South Carolina. That vote was then confirmed by the vote of the board of directors on December 14th for 20th Century Fox to approve that project. There are, of course, a library estimated at 100 million feet of film can't just be picked up and moved in a couple trucks overnight. But I called Ray Bennett 2 weeks ago and talked to him, and despite all the what we'll find out is arguments about tax codes and everything else, he assures me that when he was brought in to kind of take over Movie Tone because of the state of the Ogdensburg vaults, that after his first visit he said he was motivated by just simply all this history and this nitrate deteriorating, and that something needed to happen fast, and that they didn't have a lot of options. There were some other players at this time. UCLA had a hankering for the film. The Canadian Archives had a hankering for it as well, and I know apparently made a solid $2 million offer for the whole thing sometime in the early 70s, and that would have been, quite a steal. And the National Archives had been working with Fox Movie Tone on silent projection prints from that period, and the NARA archives have projection prints from Fox News that date from the mid-70s on. But Jim Jackson was a dynamic man, very persuasive from what I understand, and he won the day after lots of lobbying. The original plan, these are two silent newsreel cameramen, Isidore and Al Gold. They were brothers. I know Al Gold was working well into the 30s and 40s. I have not seen any records of Isidore outside of the 20s, but this is a fairly early piece of film from outside the New York studios, or a clip from a film. The original plan was that all the film, all the paperwork, all the index cards would be sent to the University of South Carolina over a period of 5 years. There would be no nitrate sent to the University of South Carolina, that Fox would underwrite the transfer to acetate of all camera negative nitrate and projection nitrate from this collection, and that South Carolina would receive brand new acetate preservation elements for use. At that time, Movie Tone News Incorporated, sorry, Peter, would have been dissolved or turned into a shell corporation with no employees. So something went wrong, and a lot of it started with Marvin Davis coming into 20th Century Fox and taking a firm hand in 1981. He was trying to move the company private. He had a lot of debt from his buyout of 20th Century Fox. I think it was over around $500 million. And, of course, one of the reasons why corporations give large gifts to nonprofit organizations is because they want a tax write-off. And so you'll see at the bottom, H.R. House Resolution 3306 and Senate Bill S-940, both from 1981. These were special bills, pieces of legislation that were entered into Congress. They were never voted on, but it was a plan that was also affected UCLA because the Hearst Metrotone Library was being donated around this time. And it turns out the attorney that was doing this for Fox was also the attorney for Hearst. So it was kind of even the same attorney was working on this legislation. The idea was that at the time in 79, you had a 5% fixed deduction that you could declare. It was going to go to 10%. They knew that. They were arguing that in the case of corporations donating large amounts of significant historical film to nonprofit archives, that those corporations should be able to take 30% annually. They were never voted on. Strom Thurmond helped put one up with Hollings, and the House resolution was sponsored by a representative from California, I think, and they never made it out of committee. Conversion logistics also got in the way. There were some questions about, again, Bennett was the tax VP, and so he was intimately aware of the tax implications of what they were trying to do. Could you write off the price of converting this film to acetate, which was an extremely expensive undertaking? If you just started printing the acetate, and if you printed it on the acetate before you actually donated the film, could you then take the write-off of the thing? And so lots of memos going back and forth about how can you manage this in a way that you can write everything off that you can and at the same time keep a kind of steady stream of film flowing down to South Carolina. They quickly realized there was no way that this was going to happen in 5 years. And it's pretty clear that Marvin Davis didn't have much interest in the program, but two annual gifts were made, and this is a still photo from Movie Tone 001, shot in August 1919. We're going to go back to some of Dan's references. The cameraman is Harry Birch in Chicago. The story is Wooden Shoes. Bill Birch is the little child here walking up the sidewalk. Bill, the son of a silent news cameraman, then went on to become a Fox Movie Tone news cameraman, a Signal Corps cameraman during the war, worked with Capra's 834 unit. Ray Harryhausen was his assistant cameraman. John Forsythe was in his unit. He returned to Fox Movie Tone when the war ended, helped to found the NBC Network News Division in Chicago in the 50s as it got rolling. And then worked as the primary cameraman in Chicago for NBC News, freelance for CBS and other news agencies as the 60s rolled on, and then made his transfer into feature films, doing a lot of primary feature work in the Chicago and Midwest area. And he has a second unit for Blues Brothers, so if you want to hear any stories about filming car crashes, you can talk with him as well. He is a special guest here because he knows so much about Fox News. He's lived with it since his birth. He's in the very first MVT-001 story. Bill Birch is sitting here a few rows up. If Bill, if you'd stand up and just let everybody see who you are. I don't need to explain the annual gifts. I got so caught up in the picture. The declaration in December of 79 was a board of directors resolution, but of course that's not there was no legally binding tax document that had been signed and blah, blah, blah. So the first gift was made and a set of signatures on March 10th, 1980. That gift comprised all outtakes of Fox News, the silent newsreel, all paperwork and index cards related to that library, and also all outtakes from the first few years of the Fox Movie Tone News Sound Edition up to about 1934, as well as all associated paperwork and card indexes. The planned gift for 1980 was delayed because why? The pesky thing about tax conditions, the initial year gift was valued at $9 million, way more than they expected. They could only write off $5 million, so they had to carry over $4 million, and that meant that they didn't have much to get next year. And so for tax reasons, they delayed the next gift. The 1980 gift arrived in 1981 at a signing. That comprised volumes 25 and 26 of the Fox Movie Tone newsreel that dates from September of 1942 all the way through to August 1944. This material was transferred onto acetate, all of it. All the nitrate was then either destroyed or rehoused. Most of it was probably destroyed by our understanding, so that the acetate elements made in the early 80s that we house in our news film library are probably the only existing elements for most of the material. Peter, one of the things that we plan to do as part of this project is to start cross-referencing a lot of that. I know that there is some nitrate that was supposed to be destroyed but then was housed back and now has wound up on deposit with the Library of Congress, and it's why we're doing this project, because we want to find out what film we actually have and in what form we have it. real quickly, suspended gift. $100 million of charitable donations just becomes unwieldy if you can only take up 5% donation every year. In 1982, Davis ordered that a conversion to acetate cease and asked the University of South Carolina if they would take nitrate. They, of course, were now fairly well into a commitment with this operation. They wanted the whole collection. They said yes. They went into negotiations with Fort Jackson Military Base, which is just east of town, to devise some suitable nitrate storage facilities. Those were arranged and in place by June of 1982. There was an apparent effort by Ray Bennett to try to salvage the deal to make sure that everything could still go. I don't, at this stage, can't find any history of any resolution beyond just a proposition by Ray Bennett about how this gift could still be completed. Current disposition. Here at USC, some of all the two gifts that I just described is physically, materially owned with all of its associated paperwork. All the intellectual and property rights there belonging thereto came with them. Movietone News Incorporated in New York, Peter's outfit, copyright licensing and research for all the remaining elements of Movietone that weren't described in the first two gifts, and the Library of Congress has on deposit for preservation and research and access issues all the film and paperwork that that pertains to the material in Movietone News, Inc. in New York. By the way, Movietone News, all is one word, comma, Inc. is a corporate designation, and Movietone News, two words, capital letters, I believe is the official name of the newsreel, but I'm still trying to sort this out myself. But you see them both times, but this is the division that makes sense to me. I think we're running now it can be shown. The Pearl Harbor footage, and this is a piece of nitrate from the war years, which deteriorated very quickly, except this was 41, so it was made on better nitrate stock. This is one of those scraps of nitrate that was supposed to be destroyed that managed to come down to the University of South Carolina. It has deteriorated over the years. This is a shot of the stern. It's a Dupneg lavender, stern of the USS Nevada. And you can see that it's had a better life in previous years than it has right now. But there's very little nitrate in our possession of the war years, and most of it is just small cut rolls that probably made it down here by accident. So a 9-minute film, Now It Can Be Shown, released to the public in December 1942 after the film shot by Al Brick on that day was held by the government. This is a print by the Library of Congress off of a projection print they have in their collection.
Sent him to Hawaii and kept him there. So he was on the scene when the treacherous blow was dealt. The fleet had been on maneuvers. Two task forces, after extensive operations at sea, steamed back to their Pearl Harbor base. This was during the final period of the phony Japanese peace negotiations, when staging a farce of talking peace, the Far Eastern double-crossers had their ships and planes on the way for the sneak punch. Their crime was well prepared as ships went on to Pearl Harbor. And then December 7th, in the surprise assault, American warplanes were caught on the ground and bombed. Most of them were disabled. That crippled our air opposition to the Japs, and their planes were able to swarm over the harbor and bomb and torpedo the warships there. A bomb hit caused the Arizona to blow up. Torpedo planes together with dive bombers and horizontal bombers coming in waves, and most of the damage was done before we had an opportunity to come back at them. vessel, we see the battleships Tennessee and West Virginia hit and on fire. There were 8 battleships in the harbor. All were damaged by the bomb and torpedo attack. 5 battleships were damaged seriously enough to be useless for some time. This is the statement by the Navy a year after Pearl Harbor. Now the facts can no longer benefit the enemy and are made public. And these movie tone pictures made by cameraman Al Brick are released by the Navy. Battleship Maryland on fire and the Oklahoma has capsized. And in the bomb and torpedo attack, high explosive hit the West Virginia. And the Tennessee, seen in the background. West Virginia has sunk in shallow water and rests on the bottom. The Maryland damaged and the capsized Oklahoma. Battleships were moored at docks in pairs, and the outer ones were torpedoed. The Nevada, attacked while steaming to leave harbor, was beached so as not to block the entrance. Destroyers, 3 were hit. 1 is back in action. 2 have been partly salvaged. 86 ships were at Pearl Harbor, and a large proportion of them were hit. The damaged aircraft is seen at Ford Island, where the motion picture camera surveys the wreckage of seaplanes. 80 Navy planes were destroyed. The crippling of air forces at Pearl Harbor was a major factor in the treacherous surprise plotted by the Far Eastern Sneak Puncher. Hickam failed. In all, 97 Army planes were destroyed, according to the figures in the plain-spoken disclosure given by the United States government to the American people about the facts of Pearl Harbor. This is the record of what President Roosevelt has called the day that will live in infamy. Infamy that this nation is avenging. The repair work begins. Damaged airplanes first. Many are quickly put into shape again and air replacements arrive. The plane losses are made good in a few days. The Pearl Harbor story begins with havoc and continues with an epic of replacement and repair. Damaged battleships are repaired. The West Virginia, the Tennessee in the background. An immense amount of work is required and is provided. Other ships are salvaged and will steam forth to fight again. The Nevada, expert salvage to put that sea giant in action once more. And the West Virginia is being raised from the bottom of the shallow harbor. The saving of the battleships is like a miracle. And here we see battleships coming back as the Japs thought they never would come back. The California is raised. Torpedo explosions cause ships to settle to the bottom. Water is pumped out to float the mighty craft. And a drama of refloating. The mine layer, Oglala. She sank below the surface. Now pontoons bring her up. And you see the vessel emerge and right herself. A reappearance after weeks below the water. Like a symbol of the repair of the harm done by the enemy. West Virginia has now been salvaged to a point where she is ready to go to the dry dock for final refitting. Much highly technical work remains to be done, and they do it. They're in the dry dock. The West Virginia is completely reconditioned, and presently the great battleship steams out to rejoin the fleet. California is towed to dry dock. In the repair of the battleships, American naval engineers took occasion to install new improvements in the vessels. Repairing them, the technicians improved them, modernizing the battleships. Of this, the damaged California is an example. They make her a more effective fighting unit than ever. Out of the dry dock comes a better battleship. The Navy tells us that most of the ships hit at Pearl Harbor have been repaired and are in action again. Here we see the vivid proof. the California steaming out for action. Cheers aboard the Nevada as that damaged and now repaired battleship proceeds out to sea to rejoin the fleet. The naval might of the United States, a year after Pearl Harbor, is greater than ever. New powerful ships have been launched, and the fleet is avenging the Jap infamy with victories like the Battle of the Coral Sea, Midway, the Battles of the Solomons, paying the Japs back for Pearl Harbor.
Until we slap the Japs right off the map.
Okay, lights, back up. And then if I need to do anything, yeah, there we go. Just a quick thing on NICBS now. It can be shown the outtakes. Again, an overview, why does USC own this film? And this is one of the interesting things about why this is a good model for this, why this collaboration is important. The ships of the line at sea shooting off their cannons and things like that were at the early beginning, and a lot of it cut into the end. Those are all pre-war films. You can tell by the state of the battleships. They have two essentially above-deck towers. The refitting of those battleships reduced that silhouette to one and a much smaller one. So even at the end when they're talking about these refurbished battleships, they're using pre-war footage. That material, because of the cutoff date and the collection, our collection starting in 42 technically, the camera negatives for all that are at the Library of Congress and part of Peter's New York outfit. The numbering system, which is how the library logged everything in the movie tone, started with a series designator in 1928, essentially zero, and then each story number would proceed in sequence of 0001, ran all the way up to the zero series, 999, and then it started a new series, series 101 to 199 and following, and that's how they logged their film into the library in New York. The movie tone story number here is from series number 48, and it's film number 7. And 4878 is from a period of December 42. It lets us know that film was returned to New York in December of 42, so it falls within the deed of gift that was given to the University of South Carolina. So although we're looking at film from 1941, which should be, if you just went by calendar dates, with the Library of Congress, officially it's officially with us. The volume and release issue, so there's no confusion, is different from the story numbers, just like a magazine or newspaper. Newsreels had volumes and issue or release numbers. Now it can be shown as officially volume 25, release 27, and there were 104 a year. This is just really quick as a way of introducing the outtakes. We're going to have two of the outtakes. They run about 6 minutes apiece. This is I love Google Earth. This is a Google Earth shot of Pearl Harbor, 2006. You can see the compass in the bottom left that lets you kind of see where we're at. Ford Island is in the middle. Battleship Row is on the bottom right corner of Ford Island. The big bump in the bottom left with all the buildings is the Navy Yard, and then across the small lock there where it says Quarry Lock and Magazine Lock, that's the area that would be the submarine pens during the attack. East Lock is an important location for the outtakes, as well as Waipio. Steve, if you're in the room, I'm not saying that right, let me know. Waipio Point, which is that finger or peninsula that hangs down. This is where the Nevada ends up at the end of the attack, beached along the stern on this section on the far left of the building, of the shot. This is a naval aerial photograph of Pearl Harbor in October 41, looking back out to sea. And you can see East Lock labeled. It designates that you get to see a better shot of where the positions of ships would be when they were moored at harbor. They all had designated moorings, so they all moored back to the same spot. Arizona moored on the same spot every time she came back in, as well as the Nevada, the California, the Oklahoma. Mary's Point is an important part. As you'll hear in Albrick's outtakes, Albrick was heading into Pearl Harbor on the morning of Sunday in a car with an officer friend of his who was on the USS Arizona. The attack actually flew over them the first waves of the attack as they were driving into the harbor. Mary's Point is the part of the harbor where officers would embark to reach Battleship Row. So when he says that that he was getting into the launch when the Arizona blew up, you can see at Mary's Point he could have only been rounding the corner and looking at the Arizona from basically that would be north. I've got my, I'm now all disoriented. That would be east, right? From the southeast, something? Direction. He would not be over by East Lock, and the East Lock area is an important location for the film because the Arizona, the footage of the Arizona being exploded by a bomb hit with the finger pointing at it was shot from East Lock. That's a definitive thing. We can track where the ships are. There's a ship in that section of the lock that's harbored, that moored there, called the USS Solis. It was a hospital ship, and what we'll see is that film was shot by a U.S. Army doctor. So the newsreel gives you the impression that the Albrick shoots Arizona exploding, but because if we triangulate the perspectives of where he could have had to have been, and I also think that it's a blow-up from 16 millimeter, that there's just that's not Albrick's film, and Movie Tone kind of glosses over that fact. I wonder why. So there are two outtakes that we're going to show, 4878B, 4878C. We're not going to show C there, so we're going to show 4878B. 4878C is a lot of the same kind of stuff. 4881B is an outtake from Now It Can Be Shown, but it's the interview of Albrick coming off the B-25 Mitchell in Inglewood, California. And he says a lot of different things on his different takes, which is why it's nice to watch the whole set of interviews. Now It Can Be Shown, this is that the 16-millimeter blow-up issue I'm talking about. That color still is taken from the National Archives. It's an official U.S. Navy film. It was probably shot by Eric Haxton, a U.S. Army colonel on the USS Solis. The reason why, if you look down, you can see USC is reversed. It's because the digitized copy I have on my desktop has this USC code on it. It's always been shown in reverse. When you see it on the newsreel, it's reversed in the way that everybody see it. The real historians kind of get it up in arms. They're like, everybody sees it in a mirror image. But if you even watch the newsreel, there's a serious degradation in image resolution when you cut back and in and out of that shot. So I framed my digitized copy of the Arizona blowing up, reversed it, and you can see it's a pretty good match. That's a low-resolution digitized image that's on the web. I'd like to see the National Archives 16-millimeter color film and be able to match it by frame if possible. But that's from East Lock, so it's pretty certain that Albrick did not shoot that film. These are the dope sheets that Albrick sent to New York for his film. You can see the date is December 7th. He started filming with a Mitchell on the first roll, switched to an IMO. There's some blue notations that discuss, and these are written in December. Four of these scenes down there at the bottom already released to us. Anthony Muto, who was Mark's Fox's guy in D.C., and they've marked off released. And then the back of this has more information, the different IMO roles. This last role is something that I'll talk about here at the end after the film. It discusses the Japanese pilot body. Technically, that apparently had already been released to them, probably because there were images that might be useful for propaganda purposes. But those are the dope sheets that he sent in. We have other paperwork associated with it, but some of that is digitized in Fu's demonstration. And if we could just roll that tape, these are two separate outtakes that run about a little over 6 minutes each. These are scenes that were shot aboard the USS Nevada, and it'll become quite clear that it's been beached here in a bit. One of the other things that's glossed over in the paperwork that it was officially sent back to Fox was that it says December 7th on the dope sheet. This, the shots of the Nevada that are here, it looks pretty calm for December 7th, and that's because it's actually December 15th. Most of our outs are silent, and when we archive material with sound, it's generally in a composite optical print. Russ always makes us a separate optical track. We thank him for it. The Nevada material, I don't know if of anything I've ever seen, and I don't think Ben Singleton's here. He handles all the distribution of tapes and licensing for the last, I don't know, what, 12 years or something like that. He has a better idea of who orders what pieces and actually uses them as opposed to just ordering it up as a screener.
Were there representative cameramen from the other newsreel companies at Pearl Harbor that day?
Not that we know of. Steve Frederick, who's here from Hawaii, brought some things that we looked at the other day. Apparently Life magazine documents that Al Brick was in Hawaii from April on. They just camped him out there. I don't see any conspiracy theories in that. But
does the Castle release of Pearl Harbor include the Fox footage, or is that the military footage?
Steve, you have the Castle, right?
Yes.
Does it? Is it that stuff on the streets showing the civilians killed and things?
And the house on fire, yeah. Seems to be in both newsreel companies, that particular house.
Okay.
So by 1942, had the battleships been refurbished, in fact, or was that in some sense some misdirection?
No, a lot of that repair work had been accomplished. They worked very quickly at doing it, and I think that's one of the reasons why, because they fudged the level of damage done to the ships here, and I think if you hold on to it for a lot of reasons, but you'd want to keep the Japanese government guessing as to how badly damaged things were, and if you were to hold this until most of the ships were about out in action, that you would, your ruse would be complete, I guess. But I don't have the dates of recommissioning or resailing of the battleships. This is from looking. That's East Lock there, shooting down at Battleship Row, headed back up toward Wheeler Army Air Force Base, I think. Not that I know. All we have is in our paperwork is a memo from Anthony Muto I think it's on War Department letterhead. It's handwritten. It just says it's dated in December of 42 that here are released to us the two cans of Albrecht's original camera negative. And so we do know that they surrendered back to Fox his actual film as opposed to Dupnag's of it. This is the next set of outtakes, and this is in Inglewood, California. There should be sound at some point. It may not be yet. There we go. And I think Lowell Thomas may actually be here because he occasionally refers to somebody by the name of Lowell.
I was on my way to Pearl Harbor when the Jap planes came over. We were about a quarter of a mile away from the gates. I was taking a friend of mine from the Arizona out to go on duty that day, when all of a sudden we heard a terrific explosion. I went right inside the gates and got my camera out immediately, set it up in the back of the car, and got a commander. I was on my way to Pearl Harbor with an officer friend of mine from the battleship Arizona when the jet planes came over. After we recognized them as being the enemy planes, I went into the public relations officer of Commander Drake so we could go out and start shooting immediately. Wherever I set the camera up, there was no worry because there was plenty of shrapnel flying all around. Yes, one fell about 30 foot away from me. Lucky it was a dud. Commander Drake and I were getting in a motor launch to go out on the bay to photograph the Arizona when she blew up. The bombing started around 8 o'clock in the morning and it came off and on all until around 10. But I kept working all day into the night and got some of the shots of fire at nighttime. And all the next day, one thing that did my heart good, Lowell, was to, in 1920, I was in Japan and photographed the launching of the Akaga and the Kagi, which were later converted into a carrier. I saw them being launched, and I saw the both of them on fire and on their backs in the Midway battle. Ships were built for battleships, but later converted into two of their largest carriers. Well, in 1920, I was in Japan for Fox News, and I photographed the launching of the Kaga and the Akagi. They were launched as battleships, but later converted into two of their largest carriers. They were both set afire and sank in the Midway battle, and it sure did my heart good to see them launched and go down.
Lights, and then I think I know everybody's tired of looking at me, but there was something happened in the last 2 days when Steve was in the building, and we were looking for things about Hawaii, and he wanted to see a film. So I want to draw everybody's attention back to the bottom of this sheet of paper on the backside of the official dope sheet for Albrecht and IMO roll number 6 that mentions the bodies of Japanese pilots being removed from the water and airplane wreckage. Steve wanted to see this story, which unfortunately was on a version of an access cassette, Betamax. We actually still have Betamax cassettes and machines that hadn't been unboxed since our last move. And I said, well, we can't show it to you. And I looked at this description, because that means it hadn't been transferred since the early 80s. I looked at the description, and there's something that doesn't make sense about the description, which is highlighted in blue on this catalog entry. This, by the way, is a snapshot of our catalog that's going to be our new catalog that will come online in about a month. So it's an easier to use version of what's up there now. But high shot servicemen dancing jitterbug, women dancing the hula, dot Navy band, dot retrieving dead bodies from the water, dot Navy band playing. I ran down to the safety vault to get the film. And quickly got it on the bench and started unwinding it. And sure enough, we get hulas. And then we have an obvious join mark here between the dance at the bottom and the scene of a pilot being pulled from the water. And this is a still shot. The pilots have been left in the water for 13 days. And that's obviously an aviation pilot. You can see the bag on his knee for the maps, et cetera, and it's... It looks like a Japanese uniform, and the rest of the film is all about Hawaii and Honolulu or Pearl Harbor. We need to do some matching of buildings, but I can say with some hope that at least that piece of missing IMO film, we might have found all or some of it this week. So that's good news. And I'm done.